We have two guests this hour, and then one guest will stay on the next hour. There is a new book out, and for all of you who care about the history of this country, this is an absolutely essential read. It is called Mary's Mosaic, The CIA Conspiracy to Murder John F. Kennedy, Mary Pinchot Meyer, and Their Vision for World Peace. The author is Peter Janney, J-A-N-N-E-Y. This is a meticulously researched and fascinating book to read. It is history, and quite frankly, once you read the book, you'll probably understand exactly what happened to President John F. Kennedy. I mean, it's that kind of a book. To share this hour with us and to stay on the next hour is our colleague Jim Mars, looking at Mary Pinchot Meyer here. James, this is a very important book.
Absolutely. Somebody wrote Mary's Mosaic just might have solved a great murder mystery. This is a must read. Oh, wait a minute. That was me. But that's true.
It does.
Very true. And let me tell you something. Actually, it's two books, okay? First half of the book deals with murder of Mary Pinchot Meyer, and who Peter Janney knew personally and had quite an affection for,
mm-hmm.
which adds a little bit even more to this narrative. And in that, it's a great murder mystery. And you'll find that this black man was arrested, charged with the murder, and then was found not guilty due to the work of a heroic defense attorney.
Who happened to be a black American
female. Yeah, happened to be a black lady. And it's a fascinating story. But then that leads us to, well, wait a minute, if he's innocent, then who's guilty?
Mm-hmm.
And Peter Janney takes us on the rest of the journey to present the evidence. Of course, needless to say, this is top secret, hidden away, right hand doesn't know the left hand, compartmentalized. But it's best we can to lay out the evidence to show you who is really behind her murder. And then he takes us into the second book, which is the relationship between Mary Meyer and John F. Kennedy. And if you've read JFK and the Unspeakable, we find that towards the end of his administration, or the end of his life, I guess I should say, he actually was turning away from the cold warrior that we all had been at one time, coming off of World War II and the Iron Curtain and Joseph Stalin and dirty communism, and was turning more towards the prospects of peace, and then again lays down, and we see the same cast of characters coming around, and the same people who had been involved in overthrowing other companies and setting up assassination plots, and it becomes very clear that it's very, very probable that the next object of their plots was the 35th President of the United States. I highly recommend it. Even if you're not that interested in the Kennedy assassination, it's a great...
Well, no, it's a walk through history.
And it shows you the connections at the highest level of intelligence and media and State Department. It's absolutely incredible, and it's written by someone who obviously knows and cares about what was going on.
That's a crucial thing, too. Peter Janney is an American patriot, like most of us listening. And Peter, let's come on up here and say hello. Hi, how are you?
Good evening, Jeff. Great to be with you. Thank you for inviting me. And I would say Jim Mars just gave a very articulate, comprehensive introduction. Thank you, Jim.
Well, thank you. And before we go any further, Peter, I've been intending to call you, but I've kind of been distracted. My mother passed away, so I've kind of been...
I'm sorry, Jim.
But I was just going to say, whatever you do, don't mention a certain supermarket tabloid. Okay?
Okay.
Just don't mention that. Jeff, they killed him on national TV
because
made a sad reference to tabloid magazine, and from there on out, the knives came out.
That's the kiss of death. That talk about cutting book sales down in a hurry. That's the idea, of course, to reduce something of this stature by linking it to a tabloid magazine.
The public pablum and try to laugh it off. And that's another point I'll make is that, you know, I've got this old line that says, I don't believe anything's true until the government denies it. And,
that's a great
again,
line. Yeah.
They trotted out, you know, some spokesman for the CIA who's going, well, this is all balderdash. Well, that's good enough for me. That tells me it's got to be on the level and it's got to be the straight truth. Or they wouldn't be coming out and trying to bash it like they do.
All right. Now, Peter, your history in this history book that you produced is remarkable in and of itself. How did you come to know Mary Pinchot Meyer?
Well, my mother and Mary Meyer went to Vassar College together. They both graduated in the class of 1942. And Mary married Cord Meyer, who was himself really, I think, on a track to be a rising star in post-World War II America. And they moved to Washington. And, of course, my father and Cord Meyer both worked at the CIA together. They were good friends. So our families hung out a lot together, and I was best friends with Mary and Cord's middle child, Michael, who was accidentally killed. He was hit by a car when we were 9 years old. So that was sort of my first introduction to death and grief, and it was a very kind of traumatic moment in my life. But it was really Mary Meyer who gave me the most support and love through the whole process. I mean, this was an incredible human being, Jeff. This was a woman who, amidst her own suffering, was still very willing and able to reach out and, support me. She supported a lot of people when she herself was going through, you know, a profound traumatic reaction over this. And this was the kind of person she was.
I don't hear stories about people like that very often.
No, and particularly, you know, not women, you know, in post-World War II America. I mean, this was a woman.
Especially in Washington.
Yeah, in Washington. I mean, this was a woman who had a very independent background, upbringing. Both her parents were very sort of avant-garde literary. Her mother, Ruth Pinchot, was a writer. Her father, Amos Pinchot, was the co-founder of the American Civil Liberties Union, as well as, you know, a big supporter of Theodore Roosevelt. Her uncle, Gifford Pinchot, was the two-time governor of Pennsylvania. They were, you know, a very well-to-do, quite wealthy family, but, of course, very left-oriented in terms of social justice.
I understand. Yeah. Now, again, your best friend, age 9, hit and killed by a car. This was the Myers child, correct?
Correct. Michael Meyer.
Okay. Right. All right. Now, they were neighbors?
Well, I would say we lived, you know, maybe 10 minutes away. They lived just across the river in McLean, Virginia. We lived in Northwest Washington.
Right. The idea of a family like that, obviously then a powerful family, a family on the move, shall we say. What was your family like?
Well, I had a very, similar kind of background. I mean, my father, you know, was a World War II Navy pilot, got the Navy Cross, came from an investment banker father, Philadelphia Main Line. You know, both my parents were financially pretty well off, and like a lot of post-World War II Ivy League men, you know, they came back from the war, I think, wanting to make sure that an event like a world war would never happen again, particularly in the nuclear age. And so the sort of beginning idealism of the Central Intelligence Agency was, well, if we can prepare ourselves well enough, we can nip anything in the bud. This was, you know, what people like Alan Dulles was trying to sell to these guys, and he was a great seducer. And he bought a whole flock of very well-bred Ivy League men into his little circle, who, as we know now, really became the vanguard of what the CIA was in during the Cold War period.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. All right, hold on right there, if you would, Peter. Talking to Peter Janney, this is really one of the most fascinating books. I have not, you know my schedule, been able to read the entire book. It's one of the kind of books, though, that with my perspective, and I think a lot of yours, and an interest in history, especially this period of history, which frankly is being essentially ignored by our contemporary media. People just don't look back at this time frame for some reason, and yet it was the pivotal time that set the entire tenor for where we are now, if you think about it. It's an amazing book called Mary's Mosaic, The CIA Conspiracy to Murder John F. Kennedy, Mary Pinchot Meyer, and Their Vision of World Peace. All right, Jim Mars and Peter Janney and yours truly will be right back with part two of our conversation about Mary's Mosaic, an American classic is what it is. The book is, again, Mary's Mosaic. Who really murdered Mary Pinchot, P-I-N-C-H-O-T, Meyer, in the fall of 1964? Why was there a mad rush by CIA counterintelligence chief James Angleton to immediately locate and confiscate her diary? What in that diary was so explosive and revealing? Had Mary Meyer finally put together the intricate pieces of a bewildering conspiratorial mosaic of information that revealed a plan to assassinate her lover, President John Kennedy, with the trail ultimately ending up at the doorstep of the Central Intelligence Agency itself? And was it mere coincidence that Mary Meyer was killed less than 3 weeks after the release of the Warren Commission report? Based on many years of painstaking research and interviews, much of it revealed here for the very first time. Author Peter Janney, our guest tonight, traces some of the most important events and influences in the life of Mary Meyer, including her first meeting with Jack Kennedy at the, how do you pronounce that school?
Choate.
Choate School.
Correct.
In the winter of 1936, they knew each other before World War II. That's an amazing relationship. All right, anything to add, Jim, and we'll go right back to Peter.
Yeah. I'd like to say that, everybody knows that Jack Kennedy liked women, and, you know, there's all the talk of him and Marilyn Monroe and Judith Exter, and we got all of them here. But obviously he was kind of a playboy. That doesn't concern me until somebody can show me that that's got absolutely something to do with his job performance, which I haven't heard anybody manage to come up with that. But what I'd like to say is that, and this is based on information I had and understanding I had before I even read Peter's book, which is, of all the women in Jack Kennedy's life, I think Mary Pinchot Meyer may have been, if not the top one, one of the top women who he genuinely had a relationship.
Well,
okay.
Think about 1936, 46, 56,
yeah.
Right? 25,
yeah, they knew
28 years.
There and, they, right. And actually, Peter, you should be the one telling about this, but they every chance they got, they were to get together. And then towards the end there, they were together quite frequently. And not just for sneaking off to the bedroom, but for state occasions, big dinners, a chance just to be together and talk, right?
That's absolutely correct, Jim. I think even more so, you know, Mary Meyer became a trusted ally for President Kennedy. And I think that was one of, ultimately, the biggest drawing cards in this relationship. That, you know, I as a clinical psychologist by training, I do think that President Kennedy, you know, had what we would call in today's parlance, you know, a kind of sexual addiction. And as unfortunate as that may sound, you know, it was just part of his makeup.
Well, Peter, some people play tennis.
Right.
Whatever.
Okay.
Whatever.
Okay.
It's an athletic skill, all right?
Okay. But, you know, this was, the way I have come to understand this, Jeff, is that this was a relationship of redemption for President Kennedy. I think that he genuinely came to understand what it meant to love somebody, to love a woman, in a multidimensional way other than just in the sexual arena. And he really trusted her. He trusted her. He respected her. And, you know, she didn't need anything from him. She wasn't after his status. She wasn't after his money. She was independently wealthy. He did, according to author Leo Damore, whose work I really draw on here, and that's a whole other story, Kenny O'Donnell, who was President Kennedy's closest advisor, had a meeting with Leo Damore before Kenny died, and he in a sense, told Leo that Jack had told him that after he got out of the White House, he was going to divorce Jackie so that he could be with Mary. This was in the fall of 1963.
Wow.
And, you know, this really was a substantial relationship, and I think one that would have gone on quite productively had President Kennedy lived.
Well, you know, that adds a whole dimension to it, Peter, in that by the fall of 63, Kennedy had felt like he'd been betrayed by the CIA over the Bay of Pigs. He felt he'd been betrayed by the military because, you know, every time he kept trying to send more advisors to Vietnam, it just got worse, and he felt like he was being sucked into something there. And, of course, his brother, Robert Kennedy, was prosecuting organized crime like never before or since. And so, I mean, they had a problem with Kennedy to begin with, and I'm sure the whispers and the gossip in Washington, if they got wind that he was going to divorce Jackie and hook up with Mary Meyer, then now he's got somebody who was the closest person probably in the whole world to Card Meyer, who knew all the deep secrets, to Ben Bradley, to James Angleton. Can you imagine what consternation that must have brought in their mind to think that those two would hook up and compare notes?
I think that's absolutely correct. The thing about Mary is that she was not going to. I mean, when she came to her senses after Jack's assassination in November of 63, which was very traumatic for her, she spent the better part of the year 1964 trying to understand what had taken place. And this is when she went and visited Kenny O'Donnell. And, of course, O'Donnell essentially said the same thing to her as he said to Tip O'Neill, which Tip O'Neill wrote in his book. You know, we were driving into an ambush in Dallas. The shots were coming from the front, from the grassy knoll, and there was an organized, at least two or three gunmen, I would say three, in triangulated fire that was really responsible for taking the president out.
Now, who are you quoting right there, Peter?
I am quoting what Leo Damore learned from Kenny O'Donnell.
Okay.
And Kenny O'Donnell shared with Leo that after Jack was assassinated, Mary was distraught. She came and visited him and wanted to know what had happened in Dallas because Kenny O'Donnell and Dave Powers were in the car right behind the president's.
All right. Hold on there, Peter.
They both said there was a shot from the shots from the grassy knoll, but they said the FBI convinced them it was in the better interest of the public not to say that.
I got it. All right. When we come back, I want to talk about Mary and after the assassination and what drove her and to what lengths she went to try to figure this out. Again, the book is called Mary's Mosaic by Peter Janney. It's a must addition to your library. It's an extraordinary book. Be right back. It's called Mary's Mosaic. Again, this is a must read. The idea of losing someone that one had been so close to since 1936, we're talking 36 to 1963, and obviously being such an intelligent, mature, wise, caring, and extraordinary woman, must have been beyond devastating. I can't even begin to come up with a mental, emotional quantification of what something like that must have been for Mary to endure. And when she recovered herself, she began to do what, Peter? What put her in harm's way?
I think her independence and her courage and her commitment to wanting to find the truth of what had happened put her in harm's way. Mary Meyer was essentially assassinated because she had discovered that the CIA had orchestrated the assassination of President Kennedy. She had put the pieces together, and she was just completely outraged by the second cover-up or conspiracy, which was going on in the media to, in a sense, confabulate this event into, a lone nut assassin having done this dastardly deed. And she knew that that was a lie, and she watched with horror as this was being sold to the American public. So when the Warren Commission came out on September 24th, she bought the paperback version. She read it. She turned over pages. She made notes. And I think this was really the impetus for her decision to go public. She wanted to go public and tell the world, in a sense, who she was, about her relationship with President Kennedy, and what she had discovered. And James Jesus Angleton, the chief of counterintelligence, the CIA, already had her under surveillance. He had her phones bugged. He had her bedroom bugged. They knew what was coming. And so they had to take her out. And so essentially, part three of my book is about how all this goes down. There are two chapters there on the anatomy of a CIA assassination, how they set this up. It's ingenious. It's kind of unbelievable in one way.
It really kind of is. But, Peter, let me ask you this, because I really want to make this point. And tell me if you disagree.
Okay.
Which you might. After, 50 years of researching and studying, interviewing, I apologize, my allergies are going nuts tonight. I've come to the viewpoint that there were people within the CIA involved in the Kennedy assassination, particularly at the highest level, because after all, this was a palace revolt, a coup d'etat. But I hesitate to say the CIA, as an official government organization, that they were planning meetings and financial meetings, and they all got together and they all plotted, and everybody in the agency said, yeah, we're going to kill the president. I just do not believe at this point that the CIA, as an official government organization, killed Kennedy. But I have absolutely no problem and totally agree with you that at certain high levels and at certain low levels where they would reach down, get to some of the hit men of the anti-Castro Cubans, to some of the mafia people they've been working with, and even to some of the military people who joined in with them, that there was CIA involvement both in high-level people and resources, and in some cases maybe some personnel. But I think a lot of them at the lower end did the CIA might have actually contributed to the assassination without even really knowing that's what they were contributing to. Would you agree with all that?
I would say I would pretty much agree with that, Jim, but I do think this was a plan that was orchestrated at the highest levels. It was highly compartmentalized.
Right.
And I would designate Alan Dulles as the project manager, even though he was technically he was no longer head of the CIA. The higher ups, people like Richard Helms, Jim Angleton, David Atlee Phillips, Robert Crowley, they were completely loyal
so
to him.
Said, let's do something, and they said, yeah, we agree with you, then bang, go, off you go. But all I'm saying is that I don't think that people within the CIA liaise with the State Department or, you know, the Farm Bureau or anybody else and said, okay, we've got this plot going. And no, it was highly compartmentalized. And that's why I say that I'm not sure. I just don't feel confident saying the CIA killed Kennedy, because there were a whole lot of people within the CIA at that time. For one thing, it's my understanding the CIA at that time was kind of divided. There were between people who really disliked Kennedy and his policies and others who thought he was progressive and kind of liked what he was doing and kind of supported him. But as you said, it was highly compartmentalized, and I think that assets and resources of the CIA were used. But I just hesitate to say that it was an official CIA plot.
I would completely agree with that, Jim.
So we're on the same page.
Yes. I think where you see the level of comprehensiveness is what happens after Kennedy is assassinated in terms of the cover-up that immediately goes into action. And, for instance, there are three separate casket deliveries to the Bethesda morgue that night.
Three.
The first of which takes place at 6:35 p.m., 20 minutes before the motorcade from Andrews Air Force, allegedly carrying the bronze casket that was supposed to have JFK's body in it, shows up. So JFK's body is already in the morgue 20 minutes before the motorcade arrives at Bethesda. And
yeah, that's been pretty well substantiated.
Yes, this comes out of the work of Douglas Horn and the Assassinations Record Review Board. And, of course, what took place here was post-mortem cranial surgery to make sure that during the official autopsy, they could legitimately say that all the shots came from behind the motorcade.
Right.
And that's what was taking place here.
We're going to go right through the break with this. So let me jump at three different caskets. Let me jump ahead a little bit. Who's, kind of sounds like an old expression, but who's buried in Kennedy's tomb?
Do you want to come? Should we answer that after the break or now?
No, we're going to dump the break. We're going to go right through here. I'm going to keep going.
You go ahead and take that one, Peter.
It's the old story. Who's buried in Grant's tomb? But I mean, you know, seriously.
Well, I mean, I don't know the answer to that. I think probably the remains of President Kennedy are in the tomb, but of course that would mean without his brain, because the brain tissue was removed from the skull.
Right.
So I feel confident in going that far, but I can't go too much farther after that.
Okay. All right. That's fine. Now, Mary Meyer began to look into all this.
Correct.
She began asking questions. She obviously was a very smart woman. Didn't take her long to pick up some very hot and very serious threads about this really hideous event in our history. What was that like? Did she know she was obviously running into real serious trouble and didn't care because of her love for John Kennedy and that she wanted to do something to try to clear this up? What were her? Well, she had a family too. Remember, so.
Well, Peter, you jump in on that one.
Okay,
I definitely have a thought on that.
I think, you know, there was a dimension of Mary that didn't completely grasp the kind of danger she could be invoking by doing what she did. I think that at the point of her death, she expected that, you know, there was going to be some rough water up ahead with her going public. But, you know, that's what she was going to do, and, you know, she was going to take it step by step. You know, she had this daily habit. She was an established artist. She would paint for several hours in the morning, and then routinely just take a walk along the Chesapeake and Ohio towpath, which begins in Georgetown and goes out into Maryland. And this is where they had her under surveillance for a number of weeks, and this is where the plan was devised that they would make it look like a random, wanton act of violence, and they would set it up in such a way that it could be pinned on someone else. They had
a lone killer.
Well, a designated patsy, just as they had done in Dallas.
Right.
And they almost got away with it.
Boy, that James Jesus Angleton is one of the weirdest looking human beings I think I've ever seen.
He apparently was a pretty strange character.
Yeah.
I totally agree with what Peter just said, and I think there's an added dimension there too, because I think that Mary Meyer, just like John Kennedy himself, I think they knew that there was danger there. I think they knew that there were factions and forces in this country, including the mafia, including the CIA, including military chiefs, who did not agree with their positions and policies, did not see the same vision they thought. But I think both of them were, let's face it, were products of World War II. And I think they both thought that, well, you know, yeah, they might try to put pressure on me. They might even, you know, come kill my dog. But I don't think either Mary or JFK, in their deepest fears, truly believed that they would be assassinated by branches of the U.S. government. It just didn't compute.
Well,
it didn't compute for the American public.
Well,
that's why it's taken 50 years for people to finally go, holy cow, I guess that's what happened.
Yeah, true. All right, very good. Now, let me ask if we can, Peter, if we can pull back. And I looked to the back of the book, and there are pieces of a crossword puzzle. The CIA is not connected to the puzzle. It's there. You got Tim Leary there, James Angleton. The pieces of the puzzle in the center, which form almost a cross laying on its right side. At the top of that cross, center would be Mary Meyer, then JFK, then the Cold War, and then the Washington Post on the bottom, moving across the date of the assassination and Dan Bradley. Now, the idea of this government being involved is a given. I think what we have to do, though, and I'm not sure, I haven't been able to read the whole book. Who else was involved beside the factions in this government? We know that this government is controlled to a substantial, significant degree by forces we don't see. And this kind of a catastrophic murder, which is really what it was, has to be planned at levels that are even above, perhaps, of the main culprits that you're pointing out in this book, or influenced. We know there's another power that remains completely invisible to the masses. What do you think of that idea?
I think there's quite a bit of credibility to it, Jeff. You know, when you look at Alan Dulles and his ties to the banking industry, to all kinds of corporate interests, and then you look at the fact that JFK was not happy about the Federal Reserve. He didn't think it was necessary. He thought the Treasury should be doing that job. I mean, he was uncontrollable in terms of going off on his own trajectory in terms of where he wanted to take the country toward world peace.
He was a true visionary. He did have a vision.
He did, but that vision, I think, was more sharply focused after the Cuban Missile Crisis. I think that became a watershed moment for this country and for the planet, actually. I mean, Jim Douglas calls the Cuban Missile Crisis the most dangerous moment in all of human history. And I think there's a lot of credence to that. And I think both JFK and Khrushchev came away from that conflict really realizing that the Cold War mentality was a dead-end street. This wasn't going to really get either one of them what they wanted. And what they really wanted was peace. They really, both of them, had an engenderment toward world peace that was accelerated after the Cuban Missile Crisis.
This wasn't, and I don't want to cast aspersions on this in any way. This wasn't kind of a New Age vision of peace and love. This was a geopolitical view that really hadn't been explored.
Correct.
And they wanted to go into that area.
Correct.
Yeah. Simply a detente, a way to work. I mean, all that began to happen long after the assassination. They were just ahead of the game. They saw it. They realized what was going on. And even with the help of Khrushchev, this has been verified by his son, you know, they said, let's start talking peace instead of war. Well, you can imagine how that set with the military and the defense contractors and the Wall Street bankers who financed the Cold War, and both sides, by the way, and that caused real problems for them.
All right, very good. Now, the book covers so much territory, but we're still always looking at Mary Meyer. What happened to her marriage?
Well, that's a fascinating question and a very important one, Jeff. And you have to remember, as people will come to understand when they read the book, that Cord Meyer, coming out of World War II, he really turned around and realized that war was just the most futile thing on the planet, and he wanted to dedicate himself to world peace after World War II. And he found a willing partner in Mary who had always been very pacifist oriented. And this was the glamour couple of the post-World War II generation. Cord Meyer became a star. A lot of people thought that he would become president of the United States. And Cord was instrumental in founding this organization called the United World Federalists. And they wanted to set up a kind of UN structure that would, in a sense, monitor every crisis situation on the planet and keep it from, you know, boiling over. So Cord, for a couple of years, just spoke to this idea, traveling all around the country, speaking relentlessly, wrote a book called Peace or Anarchy, and it was very well received. Cord was a beautiful writer. And after about 2 years, it really started to peter out because Russia began its own nuclear testing program. The Cold War, the Iron Curtain came down, and I think people basically got scared. And Cord's reaction to that was he was just very upset and depressed, and that made him all the more easy prey for someone like Alan Dulles, who seduced him to join the agency, and he became a rising star very quickly.
Well, you have to understand, too, that Dulles, as powerful as he was just kind of a functionary. He was there. He Secretary of State under Eisenhower, head of the CIA for, you know, the longest time. No, not Secretary of State. That was his brother, John Foster Dulles. But Alan Dulles has been the longest-serving director of the CIA. Before that, he'd been with the OSS. And his mentor, the guy that really put him into place, was John J. McCloy, okay, who most people don't really hear about, but John J. McCloy was head of National City Bank, which in the 30s was the largest lender of money to Adolf Hitler and the Nazis. And in fact, in the 1936 Olympics, John J. McCloy sat in the same box with Hitler. That's how close they were. I mean, this guy was a national socialist at heart, apparently. And then he got in trouble along with Prescott Bush and several other Americans who were funding the Nazi Party. But he didn't lose any positions. In fact, then he becomes a high commissioner of Germany at the end of the war and was the one who sent all the unreconstructed Nazis over to the United States under Project Paperclip and other programs to his protege, Alan Dulles, who then whitewashed their background through the CIA. And then John J. McCloy and Alan Dulles end up sitting on the Warren Commission to determine what happened.
I mean,
it's incestuous, it's insane, and yet it happened, and nobody paid attention.
Nobody. Nope. All they did was look at the names and think, well, that's a name we've heard. Must be in some real integrity there. And
big name, big famous, just impeccable credentials. He's got to be like a good guy. And yet, what I'm telling you here is, behind all of this, behind the CIA, the mafia, was the money, and the money power is on Wall Street. The international bankers.
Okay,
the very
now we're
people,
see?
The very people that the Occupy kids are all upset.
All right. Okay, now we're getting to the area I wanted to try and move to. The book itself is peerless. You'll not find a more fascinating look at history. And for those of you who still read out there, I would urge you, get the book, Mary's Mosaic, and read it. You'll feel like you know these people. You care about them, their role in history. Again, isn't this interesting, Peter, how this particular role that this decade or two played in our history is so ignored? It really is.
Well, not only is it ignored, Jeff, but I don't think we really know the truth about so many things that went on during this era. You know, this other author, John Loftus, who had a very high security clearance within the State Department to do certain investigations, he's written this new book called America's Nazi Secret, and he thinks, on the basis of what he's seen, that as much as one-third of our Cold War history is completely suppressed.
One-third.
One-third.
I agree with that. Maybe even more.
Maybe more.
Maybe more.
You mentioned post-war history. We can take the war itself. How much of World War II do we really understand, 1938 to 1945? How much of that do we really have an honest handle on?
Good point.
Not much. When I did my research, and I've been a World War II aficionado all my life, and my uncles, two of my uncles fought in Europe, and one fought in the Pacific, and my dad was also in the war. And so, you know, to me, it's not some history. This is it's what my uncles and my dad were involved in, and I thought I knew it. I thought I knew the battles and the generals and stuff, and I did, but that's not really what the history was. There was so much more to it than that. The finances. Okay, the development of the atomic bomb was nothing like what we've been told about. We were given the atomic bomb by the Nazis in exchange for immunity. I mean, it just goes on, and you're right. We just don't even know what our history truly is.
Well, we're not supposed to know.
No, they don't want us to know.
No. Peter, can you hold on a little bit?
Sure.
A little more time with us?
Sure.
Great, we'll do that after the break here. There is really so much to talk about. 30% or more of post-World War II history remains hidden, classified, buried, literally just vanished without a trace. It's amazing when you think about it. Mary's Mosaic is the book, The CIA Conspiracy to Murder John F. Kennedy, Mary Pinchot Meyer, and Their Vision for World Peace by Peter Janney, Janney. It's a classic. Be right back. Back talking to Jim Mars and Peter Janney, the author of the striking new book Mary's Mosaic, about the relationship of John Kennedy and Mary Pinchot Meyer, which went all the way back to 1936, and Mary's murder in 1964. How was she killed, Peter?
She was killed execution style, one shot to the head, and then one shot just underneath her right shoulder blade, angled slightly to the left. It severed her aorta, and it was fatal.
Mm-hmm. Which shot was first?
The head shot. I don't think the assassin expected her to live after the head shot, but she still struggled afterwards. And so it was really the second shot that just completely ended her life.
Did anyone hear the gunshots, or was this a silenced issue?
No, there had been a tow truck coming to fix an abandoned car. diagonally across from where the murder had taken place. And mm-hmm. what people will come to understand as they read the book, Jeff, is that the tow truck driver and his assistant were lured to the crime scene to be witnesses, unknowingly.
Mm-hmm.
So this was part of the whole CIA operation to set up the fact, to set up the appearance of there having been a sort of random, wanton act of violence.
Mm-hmm. So the tow truck operator and the others heard the shots, do we think?
Yes.
Okay. All right. There was an autopsy. There was the usual follow-up. This is Washington, D.C.'s most famous murder, probably, when you look at the whole thing.
It is.
What's amazing is a very similar thing happened in the Kennedy assassination. Just minutes before the motorcade ride in Dealey Plaza, there was a man who fell down. Apparently, he had some sort of epileptic fit, and they called an ambulance, and the ambulance showed up, of course, with the red lights and the siren, and everybody was distracted looking at this poor guy getting picked up. And then when he got to the hospital, he kind of jumped out and said, "Oh, that's all right, I'm okay," and he ran off, okay? And the ambulance driver, Audrey Reich, told me that this was like the third or fourth false call they had gotten from DV Plaza in the week or so before the assassination. And he speculated, and I agree with him, that they were just running this for timing, to find out how long it's going to take to get from the hospital to DV Plaza, and then on the day as a distraction. So mm-hmm. everybody's looking at the ambulance and not watching assassins move into position.
Yeah. All right. Yeah,
same MO, you know, same group.
Uh-huh. I don't want to get into too much about speculation here, but we have mentioned that this ultimately is traceable to the Wall Street money machine.
Right.
And from there, we have to look at the major banks. We have
right.
to look at the Federal Reserve System. We have to look at who owns the Federal Reserve System ultimately, directly
or
indirectly.
Jeff, I don't know if you listen to your own news, but they just announced now that a Chinese bank is buying up a major American bank. They didn't say which one. So, you know, not only are there like something like 400 bank executives and financial managers who've mm-hmm. all resigned since first of the year, they're bailing. Our economy is just shredding, and now the Japanese, we don't have to worry about a war with them. They're just going to buy us up.
Well, if they buy the Bank of America, it'll make the name change easy.
Yeah, exactly. Bank of China.
Sure. All right, so let's take this up a little higher then. Peter, what is your thought of the JFK Ben-Gurion struggle over Israel's nuclear weapons program and Dimona?
I really don't feel I can offer a legitimate opinion about that, Jeff, because it's just not an area that I've studied very thoroughly.
Understand. Your book focuses on the personal aspects of this more, and you write down in the micro level, not the macro. There are a number of theories about what would have caused people to want to murder John Kennedy. That's one of them, that Israel was going to have its nuclear weapons, as it has now, the world's third largest nuclear weapons arsenal, or else. And John Kennedy did not want that to happen. He knew where it was going. This fit into his vision and areas of world peace. He didn't want to see Israel become a thermonuclear nightmare, which it has. And we know now from U.S. Air Force white paper that I have posted that the Israelis use their weapons and have in a blackmail capacity for decades. So that's one issue.
Well, Jeff, let's just say that was one of the straws.
That's what I'm saying. That's one issue. That's
yeah.
right.
Now, surely you don't believe that the Mossad or pro-Israel Americans would kill the President of the United States, you know, and not have to worry that the Secret Service
and the FBI and the CIA
and the military and everybody would be coming after him. No, whoever killed Kennedy knew that they were going to be protected.
Yes, yes. And it sounds almost like, again, let me rephrase that. Peter, how much of the JFK mystery do we know? How much?
Well,
two-thirds?
I would say we're up to two-thirds. I think there's certainly more. There's 50,000 pages of documents in the National Archives that have not been released. That doesn't include all the material that the Central Intelligence Agency has that it won't allow anyone outside of the agency to see. And it doesn't include what's in the Office of Naval Intelligence, which we do know ran the false defector program that Oswald was a part of when he falsely defected to Russia in 1959. Again, we're back to our ignorance of Cold War history in terms of really what was going on at this time, and that there are just huge gaping holes in our historical record we should be entitled to in a participatory democracy, but we're not.
That's true. And how about this one, Peter? I can't tell you this is true because, of course, obviously I can't go and check it out, but I've been told by people in the know that a lot of the most sensitive Kennedy assassination materials are warehoused in Guantanamo. Isn't that ironic? But it also makes sense because that's one of the most secure bases that we have in the world, and we can't get to it.
What's down there? What kinds of things do they keep under such remote lock and key?
Well, I don't know. I doubt you're going to find a thank you note from Lyndon Johnson to Lee Oswald or something like that.
Was that okay? Let me go. I was going to ask Peter about that alleged comment that Johnson made to his mistress the night before. Any truth to that in your research? Did people come forward and tell you, yeah, JFK was killed, but certainly LBJ knew it was coming?
Oh, I think he was one of the players. He was wait. I mean, let's not forget that on the day of the assassination, there was a Senate subcommittee meeting reviewing the TFX contract embezzlement that had gone on, of which Lyndon Johnson was an integral part of, that he had been paid off in cash, and that they were moving to the place where Johnson would have been indicted criminally for what had taken place. And that investigation was shut down when word reached the committee that the president had been assassinated.
And that Johnson was now the president.
Exactly.
Right. There were a lot of people who, and I would probably, those people on that committee could be included in this. There were a lot of people who kind of understood what happened, but were convinced that it was in the best interest of the country not to say anything about it. Just like Dave Powers and the other aide.
Kenny O'Donnell.
Kenny O'Donnell. They both said they saw smoke and there was gunfire from the grassy knoll, but that did not end up in the Warren Commission. And later, when they were asked about that, they said, "Well, the FBI told them that it would be harmful to the nation." So there are a lot of people who acted perhaps out of the best motives, but totally, totally contrary to honesty and truth, justice that we like to claim we represent.
And yet, Jeff, Robert Kennedy and Jackie Kennedy believed that the assassination was a domestic conspiracy. And they sent their trusted friend Bill Walton to Russia several days after the funeral of JFK to talk secretly with a trusted Russian friend, Georgi Bolshakov, to reassure Khrushchev that this, in fact, had been the case, and that it was Bobby Kennedy's plan to, in a sense, begin to figure out a way to retake the throne, to come back to the presidency and renew his brother's world peace initiatives in collaboration with Russia.
Very good. All right, hold on just a second. We'll take a break, come back. Again, the book is The Remarkable Mary's Mosaic. I'm really glad you did this, Peter, for a number of reasons. not the least of which is to honor this really extraordinary woman. We'll be right back with more. Talking with Peter Janney, whose new book, Mary's Mosaic, hopefully will become a bestseller. It certainly should. And our friend of many, many years, Jim Marr, is one of the last great journalists working on this forsaken planet. Now, we have a story here that has an answer. And the big answer is, who killed JFK? The slightly smaller answer is, who killed Mary? Now, Mary Meyer was murdered probably, and the obvious punchline is, by the same people that killed JFK. Not physically the same, but the same power source. Correct? The same structure? The same group?
Correct.
Yes.
It has to be, right?
Yes.
Yes.
All right, and do we know, can we point to a particular name that is the most visible name of the octopus that ran this occupation and turned into a death of a president?
Cord Meyer.
I would say James Jesus Angleton, but Cord Meyer definitely was in the know for sure.
Well, I said Cord Meyer because according to Howard Hunt's son, he named Cord Meyer is not the absolute top of the pyramid. Alan Dulles is up there, but high ranking in the assassination chain of command.
The idea of an occupation of death in this country is really rather blatant now. So many people are killed routinely.
Oh, and now it's legal. Now all they got to do is say, I think maybe Jeff Rentz, perhaps one day in the future, perhaps
he might
be a terrorist, and then come assassination, and that's that. And it's now on the books. And the American public, dumbed down as they are, have just accepted that as the price of the war on terrorism, although I noticed on the news today, the latest terrorist event turns out to be an undercover CIA guy. Which is the only difference now between that one and all the past ones is that in the past it's been the FBI, but now it's the CIA. Big deal.
All right, well said. how's the book being received, Peter, so far?
Well, I the book sales are pretty good. I've gotten some great written reviews on Amazon.com. I'm headed toward the first major print media doing an article about me in the book, the Boston Globe. That should be coming out, I would say, within the next week.
Don't mention the supermarket tabloids.
No, I won't. But I did get ambushed, Jeff, on CNN. Which was expected.
Now, low lifes. You got to expect that, I guess.
Yep.
That's too bad. Too bad. Here they are given the opportunity to do something really meaningful in terms of journalism and bringing information to the people, and that's CNN.
Yes.
Don't let it keep you up at night, please.
Okay.
What's to come of this? What do you think this will do to history? Hopefully it'll be assimilated somehow, but it seems to me the further we get away from events of great significance and import, and the generations come and the generations go, the less we know and the easier it is for the secrets and lies to be inculcated in our history, which is constantly being rewritten.
Well, hey, let me jump in and give a quick example of that that pertains exactly what we're talking about. On CNN, here's Peter Janney trying to explain the details of his book, and he gets sideswiped, by several things, including some guy from CIA who says, oh, no, there's nothing to all of this. Okay, now, you got people who will actually read his book, and I encourage everyone to do so. Read it, study it, think on it, think where it's coming from, and think, does this make sense, and think how it fits into the other knowledge of the assassination. Okay, you're going to have one. The non-reader who simply watches TV and happens to kick around and sees the CNN post, well, the CIA said, no, that's not true. And they go on. And at worst, they say, well, the CIA denied it, so it can't be true. And next worst is that, well, the CIA denied it, but he says it's true, and, ooh, that confuses my brain, so I'm just not going to think about it. There's where we are.
But here's the clincher in this case, Jeff. What we haven't talked about is when I researched this book, I discovered that my own father, CIA father, was part of the conspiracy to take out Mary Pinchot Meyer. And that is a whole nother thread or dimension of the story that I present in this book. And I think...
That's incredible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think what it does for a lot of people is that it brings in another level of credibility to the story, you know, and which it should. But what I do also think is that here we are, we're in year 49. Next year will be the 50th anniversary of the JFK assassination. I think there is a growing body of people who are reckoning with this and are realizing that the history of their country has been, the real history has been kept from them. And that until we, as a nation, can come to a resolution of what really took place, we're going to be doomed as a country. There's a cancer on the soul of America, and it needs to be excised. And the only thing... And the only thing that can do that is the truth. I mean, my God, if Germany can deal with the Holocaust and the German people can confront this and, you know, integrate this into their history and go on as a nation, why can't we deal with the Kennedy assassination in all its veracity of what really happened? Are we that arrogant that we cannot accept the mistakes that were made and truly begin to learn from them so that we don't go recreating these kinds of events all the time, over and over again, spinning our wheels in sand? You know, we have to have the truth, because if we don't have the truth, we're going to become another Rome.
Agreed.
I agree totally, Peter, but now here's the big difference of Germany coming to their Nazi past. Hitler's dead, the Nazis, at least officially, are out of power there. So that's one thing you can talk about it. Unfortunately, in this country, some of the same family, some of the same people, some of the same forces are still here and are still very powerful. And they're working overtime to hijack history and see that people don't understand what really happened.
Very good. Peter, thank you for being here tonight, and congratulations on an extraordinary accomplishment.
It was great to be with you, Jeff. Thank you so much for inviting me. I enjoyed it immensely.
Very good. Thank you again. We'll look forward to good things, and hopefully, if I can do anything to help, I know Jim has given you a lot. His endorsement on the front cover is great. I'll be happy to do what I can for you. Let me know.
I will.
Okay. Good night, Peter.
Good night.